MacCast, Tuesday, October 23rd, 2018. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, another week, and we are now a week away from our next Apple event. Yeah, we got great things to get into in this episode, including talking about what is going to happen just about a week from now. And you'll be surprised at the location where this event is. It's not where you may have expected, and you may already know, but we're going to get into that in this episode. We'll talk about what we expect Apple to announce and all those sorts of things. We're also going to dive into the HomePod market a little bit. We're going to decipher what that R in iPhone XR means, and we'll talk about the iPhone XR pre-sales and how those are going and expectations for the iPhone XR. Get a little bit into Macs, future Macs, maybe with Apple chips, a little bit of car stuff in here. We're going to take care of BeautyGate and also talk about Apple's new video service. And it's looking like we have a pretty good idea now when that is going to arrive on the scene here. And then we are going to get into some of your feedback, a little more follow-up on doing clean installs of macOS Mojave, because I know some of you still haven't done the Mojave update yet. We're going to talk about in-car notifications, some more Mojave questions in general, and also help a listener out with some time capsule issues, and that will round out this episode of the MacCast this week. So it should be a good one. We're just going to dive right in and get to the main event. Apple has sent out invites for their next event. It's going to be happening on October 30th. Not in Cupertino, not at Apple's new campus, not Apple Park in the Steve Jobs Theater. Nope, it is at the Howard Gilman Opera House at the Academy of Music in New York City. And it's still starting at 10 a.m., but this time around, Eastern time. So that means for us West Coasters out here, yep, we got to get up early to catch that live stream. And it is going to be streamed 7 a.m. Pacific, 10 a.m. Eastern on October 30th. And I think we talked about this on the last episode of the MacCast. It wasn't too surprising because actually this week, Tim Cook is in Brussels at a conference doing a keynote. So I had originally thought the event might be happening on the 26th, but that was ruled out when we heard about that keynote. And the invite was really interesting this time around. Actually, more interesting was the page that Apple put up for information about the live event and the stream and stuff like that. They actually put up a page this time around, and every time you hit that page on Apple's website, it revealed a different version of the logo. So the tagline for this event is "There's more in the making," and it looks like it's going to be content creation, maybe art-focused, maybe leaning toward the fact that they may have a new version of the Apple Pencil to go along with what we're expecting them to announce, which is the updated iPad Pros. But when you load that page on Apple's website, it loads a different sort of artist interpretation of the Apple logo. And I've only seen maybe about a half a dozen, but a diligent person out there on Twitter actually took the time to refresh and refresh and refresh that page and found out there are 370 different variants of that logo that can possibly load up on that page. So we're expecting it to be somewhat art related. I don't think we need to go into too many details about what the iPads are expected to have. We've covered those on a lot of the past episodes of the MacCast, but basically we're expecting new designs taking cues from the latest iPhones. So minimized bezels, Face ID, no home buttons, 11 inches and 12.9 inches, so the 10-inch iPad Pro getting a little bit larger screen, but a smaller form factor because they're going to reduce those bezels. And one of the big major changes that's expected to happen is USB-C connectors on this year's iPads instead of the Lightning connectors. Again, we talked about that in previous episodes. And just as an aside, this week, USB-C related, Apple released a USB-C Apple Watch charge cable that you can now pick up. So Apple definitely moving in the direction of USB-C more and more. I'm fully expecting maybe next year's 2019 iPhones will make the move and transition to USB-C as well. I think that's going to become the standardized connector, the next connector to replace Lightning. So we're expecting the new iPad Pros. We're also possibly expecting them to talk a little bit about the Macs, although there's some speculation they could just update the Macs quietly in the background. But we've been hearing a lot of rumors about an updated Mac Mini. What that actually means, there's kind of two theories that they're just going to update the Mac Mini with some new specs and internals, but there's also been that rumor floating around that they may do a Pro version of the Mac Mini. So maybe we'll get something tacked on the higher end, on the upper end there to satisfy the Pro users. And also on the Mac front, we're expecting this new lower-priced MacBook, which also kind of brings into question the future of the MacBook Air. And the idea is that Apple will have a new lower-priced MacBook, kind of bring the price point down, and that there also may be a new larger 13-inch MacBook Pro version to kind of replace the Air. And so those two lines, I think, merging makes a lot of sense to me. But there's features in the Air that certain customers like the additional ports and stuff like that. So the question becomes, is Apple going to update both? Not really clear at this point. We should find out toward the end of the month here. And then we're also expecting some sort of iMac update, likely just going to be a refresh of the line. They might not even talk about it at the event, I don't think. It could just be, again, updates that are pushed out, new Intel processors or updated Intel processors and architecture, GPUs, all those sort of things. Although there is a rumor floating around that they could possibly have, quote, significant display performance upgrades. What that means, again, not really clear. Faster refresh rates, maybe True Tone, something like that. So if you've been waiting on new Macs, end of the month here might be your time for those to come along. And there's one other model of the iPad that we haven't addressed or talked about in a really long time. Apple has really ignored for a really long time, and one that is very loved by many of you out in the MacCast audience. I know this because I hear from you vehemently when I talk about the fact that the iPad Mini, I think, is going away. I don't think there's going to be an update. I think with the new larger iPhones, the iPhone XS, there's not much space left around for the iPad Mini, but many of you disagree with me, and Ming-Chi Kuo, a famed Apple analyst and often a guy who knows about these things, says he's expecting a new iPad Mini equipped with upgraded processors and a lower cost panel coming sometime soon. He stops short of saying exactly when, only saying late 2018, maybe early 2019. Apple sometimes does a spring event, so maybe they do a spring event announcing, I don't know, maybe something we'll talk about a little bit later in the show, maybe a more media-related event, and they come out with a new iPad Mini. So that could happen. Great news if you are an iPad Mini fan out there. And Ming-Chi Kuo also gave a kind of time frame for a few other products that we're expecting to get updates. The AirPods, maybe new version of AirPods, and also the final release, or finally Apple finally releasing, rather, the Air Power Mat. He's expecting that in the same time frame, maybe late 2018, early 2019. So a spring event with the announcement of new AirPods, Air Power, and Mac Mini, along with, you know, another media announcement, could be a nice little start to 2019. So maybe they'll hold off on all those until then. But I'm super excited about the iPad Pro event. Of course, we'll be covering it here on the MacCast, so stay tuned for that. If you have any thoughts on the upcoming event, shoot those along, maccast@gmail.com. Ah, the HomePod. I am a huge fan of the HomePod. As you know, I love mine. I use it every day. I use it all of the time. But a lot of people like to talk about the HomePod as sort of a failure, saying it hasn't sold that well. It's not doing that really, really well in the smart speaker market. Well, this week we got a report out from Strategy Analytics. They did a survey of 1,011 U.S. smart speaker owners or purchasers from between July to August of this year, and they crunched the numbers, found out the HomePod accounts for just about 4%, not very much, 4% of the smart speaker market. But there's a little bit of a silver lining in here. You know, it's really not too surprising that the HomePod is not making a dent in the overall smart speaker market. Amazon is dominating. I think that's no surprise. 61% of the total market with their Amazon Echo line. And, you know, they've got Echo Shows and all kinds of variants with screens, not screens, different sizes, different price points. The biggest one, biggest seller for them, I was a little surprised by this. I thought it would be the cheaper Echo Dot. It's actually the Amazon Echo, 23%, 21% for the Echo Dot, and then the other models sort of rounding that out. Google Home doing pretty well, also 17% of the market with the Google Home at 8% and the Home Mini at 7%. Of course, the one device that Google has that sort of competes with the HomePod in terms of features and price is the Google Home Max. That has 2% share. So the HomePod did beat out the Google Home Max. And if you remember back in September, Apple, the strategy analytics also claimed, that Apple had 70% of the plus $200 price point market for smart speakers. So they've really carved out the premium end of the market as the space that they want to play in with launching their product. You know, obviously Amazon's dominance is coming because of price, and also I think because a lot of owners of Amazon Echo products are buying multiple units because you can get cheap dots and throw them all around your house, and then you have kind of whole home coverage. Apple really doesn't have an affordable solution for that yet, and so that's kind of rekindling rumors that Apple is playing around or thinking about expanding the HomePod line, offering some sort of less expensive option. Maybe that could come in a media event in September as well. That might be actually the right timing for it. I think they're going to wait out the HomePod through the holidays, though. I don't think we're going to get any kind of announcement of a new HomePod at this October event. I think it's too soon. I think the HomePod, even though it's not making a huge dent in the smart speaker market, I think Apple is probably pretty happy with how sales are going. I think they're selling plenty of them at this point, and I think they are going to be on a lot of Mac and Apple fans' holiday wish lists. So I think they're not going to make any rush to any changes with the HomePod. But it's natural for Apple at any point to expand out the line. They've done this with every product they've ever released, right? From the iPod to the iPad to the iPhone and so on and so on. So it will expand out at some point. The question is when, and it would be nice to have a less expensive option, again, to kind of get that whole home coverage for a smart speaker. As more and more people get smart home devices, I think it makes sense for that sort of thing to happen, and I think it eventually will. So iPhone XR is coming out. Pre-sales happened last Friday. They are shipping out this Friday. And Phil Schiller's doing the rounds talking about the iPhone, and he did an interview with Engadget, and they asked him, you know, what does the R stand for in iPhone XR? And he just commented saying, you know, the letters that Apple uses for its products never stand for anything specific. A lot of people want to read into those letters, but they're saying nope, not really anything specific. So he did comment that like he likes sports cars, and S and R often are there to mean kind of the performance, more sporty cars. And definitely I think the iPhone XR with its bright colors and great features kind of fits that description. So that made a lot of sense for him to make comments on that. He also did comment on the screen issue, the pixels per inch issue. And I don't even really think this is an issue, but you know, many people denoting, hey, the iPhone XR screen doesn't have a true 1080p display. It does have the same pixels per inch that the iPhone 4 has had, but I will also point out that it's the same pixels per inch that every iPhone since the iPhone 4 has, all the way through up to and including the iPhone 8. So that form factor, always 326 ppi. That's the thing from the very beginning that Apple coined Retina, meaning you can't discern the individual pixels. And Phil Schiller's point there was that if you quote, if you can't see the pixels at some point, the numbers don't mean anything. They're fairly arbitrary. And he added, I think the only way to judge a display is to look at it. And I have to say, I don't think he's wrong. You know, you need to go see that thing in person before you really judge it. I think most people are going to be very happy with that display. Most people aren't getting bogged down in the pixels per inch, other than maybe tech analysts and really nerdy folks and people who really care about this stuff. And for those folks, the iPhone XR is not your phone, because you're buying the premium phone. You're buying the XS or the XS Max. And before those of you who are thinking about this start to write in and say, well, you know, it's not HDR, it's not 1080p, and there's cheaper Android phones that have that, I get it. I totally understand that. Again, I think you're the market that cares about that stuff. And really, at the end of the day, we're talking about a phone screen. Do you really need HDR, 1080p, 4K on a teeny tiny phone screen? I don't think that's the experience you're looking for. If that's what you care about, get a really nice OLED display for your living room. You know, let's get 65, 70 inches, a big, bright display that looks awesome for watching films. If you're concerned about the quality on your teeny tiny iPhone screen for video, yeah, I don't know. I know there's a lot of people out there that watch YouTube stuff, and you can get it in 4K and you can get it in HDR now, but I just don't think the average person is really going to be able to tell the difference. So I think a lot of people are making a big thing of nothing. Now, I will tell you one thing that's been bothering me with a lot of analysts and reports and people who are talking about the iPhone XR is them using this term, quote, affordable, or saying you're getting a premium phone at a not premium price. And this is only bothering me because the iPhone XR, while it is more affordable than the XS or the XS Max at this point, is a $749 phone, or a $799 phone, really, if you want the 128 gigabyte storage option, which I think is the right storage size. So it's still an $800 phone. That is a premium price phone. Remember the original iPhone price? $499 and $599. That was before they dropped the price. The iPhone 8, last year's premium phone, or one of last year's premium phones, $699. So the iPhone XR is actually more expensive by $50 than last year's iPhone 8. So these are still premium prices. I'm not saying you're not getting a great value in it. I'm not saying it's not a great deal in comparison to Apple's lineup, but let's not pretend that this is a quote-unquote affordable phone. If you're looking for an affordable smartphone, you know, an older model of iPhone or an Android phone is probably the thing that you're going to want to go for, right? Go for one of the, you know, iPhone 7S models, for example. But hey, if you want to get the latest, greatest technology, if you want to get the best thing that Apple is offering this year at the most affordable price, then absolutely the iPhone XR is your model. And I think the iPhone XR is the model for a lot of people. And many of you agree with me because pre-orders went up and I heard from a lot of you who got your orders in. So congratulations to you. There didn't seem to be a problem ordering this year. Apple seemed to have plenty of pre-stock, although that is causing some analysts and folks to allege that maybe the phone isn't selling that well. I don't think that's the case. I think Apple planned for this. I think they know it's going to be a huge seller. But after phones went on sale Friday, models and configurations continued to be available in multiple colors, multiple storage options and sizes, all the way through up to and including until Monday this week. And that's when we started seeing stockouts and delays with phones not shipping here at the end of the week. Apparently, the yellow and product red models seemed to sell out the quickest. It wasn't clear if the yellow sold out because Apple didn't make as many of those or if it was just a really popular color. I have to tell you, if I was buying one, I'd be buying the yellow. I think it's gorgeous. Although most of you who wrote in said that you were very interested in the product red. That seemed to be the most popular model. A lot of people just going for basic black as well. So it'll be interesting to see how the colors play out. The coral is an interesting color because I see it in some lights and I think it's orange, but then it kind of has that more salmon pinkish color to it. So I'm looking forward to actually seeing these in store in person, and I am planning on going in and checking them out. I want to actually compare them up with the iPhone XS, which I haven't seen in person either. So I'll be giving you my thoughts and impressions on a future episode of MacCast. But if you have your own, please write in and share those with us. And just finally, Ming-Chi Kuo also commented on demand, saying it was better than that of the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus. So all signs are pointing to the iPhone XR being a very good seller for Apple. We also got some data this week on how the iPhone XS series sales were going, and the answer is pretty strong. The data came from Consumer Intelligence Research Partners. They say basically orders have been split between the iPhone XS and the XS Max, about 50-50. In the quarter, they say those two models accounted for 16% of U.S. iPhone sales. This is despite the fact that those models were only available for 10 days of the entire quarter. And that's impressive because the iPhone X accounted for 14% of iPhone sales, with the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus accounting for 15% and 17% respectively. So iPhone X S models, S series models are also selling very well. So all signs pointing to Apple having very good Apple numbers when they give us their first quarter 2019 quarterly results. That's the fourth quarter, fiscal quarter of the year. So that final holiday quarter, Apple should do really well with iPhone. I think this year's iPhone lineup is kind of an amazing one. And just moving back to the iPhone XR, because we are on launch week, Apple has gotten units out into the hands of reviewers and influencers and things like that. We saw some hands-on videos pop up earlier this week, and I have to tell you, all the reviews, I don't think too surprisingly, were super positive, many noting that there seems to be very few reasons to actually pay the $250 to $300 premium to get the iPhone XS or XS Max. Again, if you don't really care about really specific tech numbers, things like the OLED display versus the LCD display, the pixel count, you know, pixel per inch, pixel density, if those things matter to you, then you're going to want to go for the other models. But if you don't really care, if you don't think you're going to miss 3D touch, if you don't think you're going to miss that telephoto, you know, 2X lens, then the iPhone XR is just an amazing, amazing device. And reviewers are, you know, trumpeting that in droves. One thing I noticed about this year's early release videos, the folks that got their hands on iPhone XR units, and I think this makes a lot of sense, is it wasn't your typical really high-end tech publications and tech pundits. Those folks still did get them, but Apple also sprinkled them out to a number of YouTube lifestyle and tech influencers, and a lot that have more kind of common markets, I think, that aren't so tech-centric. And I think that is the perfect alignment for the iPhone XR, because it really is, I think, the mass market phone that Apple put out this year, the premium mass market phone with all of the great new features. And, you know, I think overall the iPhone XR, despite not being a cheap phone, still being a premium priced phone, I think it is where the big value in this year's iPhones are. And John Gruber pointed out a little way that a lot of us missed where it's adding additional value, and that's in the storage options, because that default model at $749 is 64 gigabytes of storage, and I think John rightly points out that that's not quite the sweet spot anymore for storage, really about 128 gigabytes. If I look at my iPhone, I have almost exactly 64 gigabytes. So just a little bit more headway with 128 gigabytes. And with the iPhone XR, that price jump is only $50. So you can jump up for $50, double your storage, and be in that storage sweet spot. The problem with the iPhone XS models is they don't have that sweet spot. They start at 64 gigabytes. That's not going to be enough for more people. So you're really buying at the mid-tier, and that's a $150 price jump to get up to 256 gigabytes of storage. So to get enough storage, you're actually even paying $150 more. So it's more like a $400 to $500 price difference between the iPhone XS, XS Max, and the iPhone XR. So again, for all of these reasons, I think the iPhone XR is just going to be a huge hit this year. And then lastly, on the iPhone XR stuff, we now know also what the repair costs are going to be, sort of the cost of ownership beyond, you know, the fact if you have AppleCare with accidental damage and theft damage. We're talking about out-of-warranty repairs, screen replacements, and other damage. And for the iPhone XR, it's going to be right about in line with the prices you would have paid for an iPhone 8 Plus, which absolutely makes sense. They're about the same screen size, close to same form factor. So it's $199 for screen replacements on your iPhone XR, $399 for other damage. Again, this is out of warranty. For perspective, the iPhone XS Max is $329 for the screen replacement and $599 for replacement of the device. So a little bit more affordable. AppleCare Plus, if you want to get that on your iPhone XR, is just $149. And so I would say if you're a habitual abuser of your iPhones, if you're hard on your iPhones, if you drop them and crack your screens a lot, you might consider getting the AppleCare Plus. I think it's a good value and a good deal. Nice little add-on to have, especially, again, with that accidental damage. And I almost always, with my iPhones and iPads, buy AppleCare. So, love to get your thoughts on AppleCare, and do you buy it with your devices? Shoot us some feedback and emails, maccast@gmail.com. But that's kind of the latest on what's happening with iPhone XR, and I look forward to hearing from many of you as you get your units. You know, what do you like about them? Are you missing any of the features? What are your thoughts and opinions? So please feel free to email in, write in, send audio comments, and comment on that as well. I think by this point, with Apple's A-series processors, Apple has proven time and time again that they made the right decision in moving chip design in-house for their mobile devices. Those things are screaming powerhouses of power and efficiency when it comes to batteries, and I think all those kudos go to Apple's engineering team for making that happen. And so ever since we've been getting these impressive chips on our iOS devices, there has sort of been this question: when is Apple going to do their own chips for their desktops and notebooks? It actually was originally rumored all the way back in 2012 by Bloomberg that Apple was working on or thinking about chip designs for future Macs, that eventually they would move away from Intel, they'd bring their chip design and prowess to the Mac. The question has always been, when is that going to happen? Well, this week, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo has been telling his clients he thinks it's going to happen in 2020 at the earliest, but no later than by 2021. He thinks that Apple's longtime chip partner, TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, they're going to be tapped to do the production of chips for a future Mac based on some form of the A-series processor, which I guess in that time frame would be a variant of maybe the A14, A15 design. I'm sure tweaked for desktop. We know that Apple will tweak processors, those A-series processors, even just for like the iPads. The iPad Pros are likely going to have a tweaked will have a tweaked A12 design, like an A12X or something like that. And typically what they're throwing in there is additional GPU cores, so additional graphics processing. But it makes a lot of sense for Apple to eventually move to their own processor designs. He points out some of the benefits. He said Apple wouldn't be plagued by the Intel release cycles and often delays in chips. They could benefit from higher profits due to lower processor costs if they're making them themselves. There's also possible PC market share gains if Apple can take those savings and produce lower cost Macs and bring the price of desktops and notebooks down a bit. And then it just allows Apple to have better product differentiation from their competitors, right? They're using their own processors. And what that really means, I think, is what we've seen them do with iOS devices, right? Tighter integration of the hardware and software, allowing Apple to actually get better performance and do more things with less processor stuff, and also integrate more things. Recent examples include things like the Neural Engine, which allows them to do much more with AR and machine learning tasks on the device, or the enhanced image signal processor that we have in the iPhone XS and XS Max, and the iPhone XR for that matter, in the A12 chip, right? That's allowing them to do all this cool photo stuff on the iPhone. Obviously, they're going to be doing different things on a desktop or a notebook, but it's the same sort of thought processes that go into those chip designs, right? They can integrate that stuff much more tightly. It's also going to allow them to control the power profile, meaning longer battery life and better performance in our laptops, which is something we're always striving for, right? The number one feature you hear about when, you know, people asking about when a new notebook comes out is, how good is the battery life? How much improved, you know, how have they improved the battery life? And Apple has hired a bunch of, as we know, chip designers on the power side of things as well. So integrating that all into future Mac designs could be a very, very good thing. And most of the reports here feel that Apple will approach laptops first with their own chip designs. I think, again, this makes sense because the A-series processors that are in iPads are already said to be having close to laptop-level performance. And so making that jump, making that transition, I think is going to be a little bit easier. And especially if they do it with a lower-priced model, I think it's going to, you know, like a MacBook, it's going to make that transition even smoother on the consumer side of things. I think consumers would be more willing to test out and test the waters with an Apple-designed chip at the lower end of the price market, see how that does, and then move it up into their Pro line. But I don't know. What do you think about this? Are you excited about Apple-designed processors in future Macs? I certainly am. It just sounds like there's going to be benefits all the way around. And I think, again, because they've proven themselves so well with the A-series processors, I don't think I have any reservations about buying a future Mac that features an Apple-designed processor. I think it's going to be pretty darn incredible. We've got a little more Apple Car stuff this week based on a couple of patents that surfaced. And I don't typically talk about patents, but I think this week it kind of shows some of the thought processes Apple's going through with their car designs and what they're thinking about with autonomous driving systems. A bit of this stuff came out because of Apple Titan car-related news this week. Now, that project, of course, shut down, but Apple had patent filings and things related to it that they were working on, and that sort of surfaced this week. So the first thing that kind of came out was a patent application for a converter architecture, basically taking the high-voltage battery energy needed for a car, an electric car, and converting it down to a lower voltage suitable for subsystems in the car, like things like air conditioning, you know, dashboard instruments, infotainment units, and stuff like that. Now, most vehicles, including electric cars that are on the road today, use converters for this, but Apple is trying to patent a system for making them more efficient and more reliable. So tweaking around the technology and working on that. But what was interesting that this patent seemed to reveal is maybe some of the tech that came out of the Titan project and what Apple was thinking about in designing a autonomous vehicle or an electric vehicle. And we had sort of heard about this during the rumors around the Titan project that Apple was targeting really high-end performance cars, sport performance. And what came out was that in this battery stuff, this converter stuff, they were looking at converting down a system of like 800 volts. And that is serious high performance. To put that in perspective, a Tesla Model S uses a battery voltage of about 375 volts. So they were playing around with like some screaming high-performance car tech. And of course, maybe they would have throttled it back down for a more consumer product, but considering that they sort of scrapped the whole thing altogether, I think we'll never really know. But, you know, Apple doing a probably performance electric sports car was what they wanted to put out, you know, something more in the supercar range. And that would have made sense for Apple, I guess, for kind of the thing that they led off with. But now we know they're working more on an autonomous car system. But something else that came out in the patents this week was a system for cars to sort of convoy or use Pelotron, basically drafting to improve their efficiency and range and to kind of save on battery drain. So basically the idea would be here would be that when you're driving on the road, you could put your car, your Apple autonomous car or your autonomous car using the Apple autonomous car system into a mode and it would sort of just slot in behind other cars that shared that same system. And they would use, you know, communication to and sensors and stuff like that to pick up and figure out the optimal follow distance. But not only do that, they would also send information about which vehicle was doing better in terms of battery, you know, which one had more of a charge, and they would prioritize the location of the vehicles in the lineup, putting the higher level battery cars at the front, creating a draft for those that had less battery, and sort of balancing it out for everybody that was in the little convoy. And then I would assume if you pull out, your exit comes up, your car kind of pulls out of the chain and the other ones line up. So really interesting stuff. Not only that, they also included a system for doing on-the-road refueling from car to car. So there'd be, you know, basically it looked like to me almost like a tailpipe that would extend out, really a connector that would extend out, and then in this convoy connect to the car behind it. So you'd sort of create this car human centipede, and each car could again detect the battery levels of the other cars, and all of those cars could then benefit, and cars with more battery power could then refuel or transfer their reserves back to cars with less power, and everybody could sort of benefit. And this mode would involve sort of opting in, and I think it could be even cool if you could almost like sell a little bit of power to other cars and other vehicles on the road. But all really interesting stuff coming out this week, and just gives you, again, some insight into the thought processes that Apple and their engineers were going through with tech around electric vehicles and maybe the future of transportation. And I found it to be pretty interesting stuff. So we got to dive back into BeautyGate real quickly, only to say that our short BeautyGate nightmare is over. And in case you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to a previous episode of the MacCast. Basically, when the iPhone XS and XS Max came out, there were these allegations and things being alleged that Apple was using some skin smoothing technology in the FaceTime camera to make your portrait selfies look better. But that was totally debunked, and people were saying, nope, that's not what's going on here. It's just how the new HDR technology is working, and Apple is having to apply some heavier denoise stuff because of just how the whole system was set up. And that made a lot of sense, and just through a lot of analysis, it was sort of debunked at that time. Well, The Verge revealed that Apple has actually confirmed that they are adjusting a setting in the Smart HDR algorithm in the upcoming release of iOS 12.1, and it should specifically address this issue. So it wasn't just the lens system and Apple doing denoise on purpose. There was actually a problem with the system, and the system is now being tweaked to preserve more detail. And what the bug actually was having to do with the multiple exposures that it was taking with Smart HDR, and more specifically, the intelligence system in the device picking the right frame or choosing the frame that it was going to use to create the Smart HDR effect. And what was going on was it was picking frames wrongly that had longer shutter speeds. And when you're in a low light situation with a longer shutter speed, what you tend to get is an image that is more blurry. So you were getting a little bit of blur in that exposure, and then that was being merged in by the HDR system, which was causing you to lose detail in the process and get this sort of smoothing effect. Good news is that is going to be fixed with iOS 12.1, which I think they're out on their third or fourth beta with this week, so we're expecting that update to hit the rest of us, the general public here, pretty soon, probably in line with the release, I would imagine, of the iPhone XR at the end of the week. So probably by the end of the week, you're going to have that update. And if you've been suffering from overly smooth skin or just general loss of detail in your iPhone photos on your 10S or 10S Max, that should be corrected. And I'm going to look forward to that because I did notice that in a lot of my images, just the general, I almost call it like a watercolor effect, this sort of loss of detail, loss of texture. And it's going to be nice that that will be resolved. And then finally in the news for this week, I want to get into Apple's rumored video service. We've been wondering, when is Apple going to make that available to us? There's been a lot of speculation about it. I was thinking it was going to be sometime in the first part of 2019, and it's looking like that is going to be the case, at least if you live in the U.S. And before you get frustrated with that statement, hold on, because there's some good news in here for you as well. This information came about from a publication called, surprisingly, The Information. They claim to have the scoop on this, citing several sources within Apple who are telling them that Apple plans to roll out their video service in the U.S. first, but they do want to quickly expand that service to more than 100 countries, possibly, quote, within months. So they want to do a very, very fast rollout. Of course, this stuff is all very difficult because you've got to get different kinds of approvals and things for entertainment content and content distribution in various countries. But sounding like Apple has a vested interest in working very hard and very quickly on that. So unlike maybe things in the past like iTunes rolling out to different countries or iTunes stores rolling out to different countries, Apple is wanting to roll out their video service very, very quickly. Now, another good piece of information that came out of this report was a backup of some of CNBC's claims from last week that we talked about, that Apple does plan to roll out their new video service and original content for free to current owners of Apple devices. That means it's not going to be an add-on to the Apple Music service. It's not going to be an additional subscription cost. If you own an Apple device, an iPhone, an iPad, an Apple TV, a Mac, you are going to have access to these new original shows and video content completely free. So you might ask, where's the revenue coming? Well, Apple plans to sell other premium services within their TV app, services like HBO and Stars. They're going to pay for that content and then sell it to you and make revenue that way. The report says they are still working on those deals with the providers, trying to hammer those things out. But assuming that happens with enough significant providers, it's sounding like this is how the service is going to roll out. And I am super excited about it. I'm super excited about the shows and content. And I'm even more excited now to know that I'm not going to have to pay an additional subscription price to get access to that content. So last thing related to the video service is a little announcement that Steve Carell is going to be joining the cast of Apple's upcoming drama series, which we already knew about, the one about a morning talk show. And that's the one starring Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. So Steve Carell getting added to that cast this week, just making that content in that show even more compelling at this point. And, you know, Apple's doing all sorts of shows from, you know, sort of family shows, sci-fi shows, even some, I think, documentary style shows and things like that. And the lineup keeps growing and I couldn't be more excited about it. So early 2019, sounding like this would be the kind of announcement they could do maybe at that spring announcement we were talking about earlier. So I think that's when it will happen. So stay tuned for that, maybe sometime around March, April, May, probably in the April timeframe. So we'll, of course, be following that and keep you updated here on the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. You know, I want to talk to you about Text Expander. Probably, I hate to say my favorite app that Smile makes, but probably the one that I use the most. I am a huge fan of PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, you know, as well. Actually, everything that Smile makes, I absolutely love. But Text Expander, just, I love because it is so vital to my everyday workflow. It completely saves me time and a lot of effort in doing things like answering emails or just little daily things. Like I have snippets set up for a lot of my coding tasks that I do. And essentially, Text Expander helps you communicate smarter. It lets you create snippets for things that you type commonly, things that you might copy and paste all the time. You can build snippets for. You can set them up for things like email addresses. I use them for email signatures, website addresses, even things like entering date and timestamps. I have a few set up for that in different formats. Also, you can make snippets for longer things that you use regularly. Directions, I have one that is just a list of all the local microbrew pubs, because I have friends and family who come in who know I am a huge craft brew fan, and I love to go out to the breweries. So they just say, hey, where are all the breweries around? I have addresses and URL links, everything in a simple snippet that I can just put into an email very, very quickly. Answers to common questions I get on the MacCast. I do those all the time. And what's really cool is you can set up things like fill-ins, and you can set up logic and customizations so they don't just feel like canned answers all the time. And it's great for support teams. It's great if you are in a business or working on a team, because you can share your snippets, and they work across multiple platforms, Mac, Windows, iPad. And if you ever have trouble remembering a snippet or an abbreviation, you can set up a hotkey to search for them. So just quickly find them, figure out what they are, and use them. And it is just really great and amazing. And best of all, if you visit textexpander.com/podcast right now, they will give you 20% off your first year subscription to Text Expander. And I just can't say enough about it. You know I love it. You know we love Smile here. And just check it out, textexpander.com/podcast. Get on Text Expander. You're going to love using it. And a huge thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. The past couple of episodes, we've been talking a little bit about Mac OS Mojave. People are upgrading. They're installing it. More specifically, we've been talking about my clean installation. You know, this time around, I hadn't upgraded in a while. It had been a while since I'd done a real clean install of my operating system, and so I wanted to do that with Mac OS Mojave. So if you want to hear about the details of me doing that and some of the follow-up to that, go back and listen to the last couple episodes of the MacCast. But this week, I had a little bit follow-up on the gotcha that I told you about last week, and that was if you have multiple user accounts set up on your Mac and you're planning on doing a clean installation, one thing you want to make sure you do when you set up your new system is that you install those or set up those user accounts in the same order that you set them up on your original system. And I pointed out the fact that it might be hard to remember, you know, when did I add those and what order did I add those in? And so a thing that could help you is figuring out the user ID of each account on your system. And I gave a tip for that, how to do that, in the last episode of the MacCast, but mine involved having to kind of get those user IDs one at a time. Well, Steve wrote in this week as a follow-up and gave me a better terminal command that you can use to get those user IDs. And the command, I'll have it in the show notes at maccast.com, but it's basically ls, which is the list command, space dash n, and then space forward slash users, which is the users directory at the root of your hard drive that has all of your user accounts in it, basically all your home folders, right? So if you run that command there, the third column in the results will be your account user IDs or UIDs. And you can just go down the list. As I said in the last episode of the MacCast, typically 501 is the first one, but you can see which user ID is assigned to which account, and then you can set those up and recreate those on your new system in the correct order. That same command will also list out the account names, so you can see the actual username that you used for each account, which sometimes isn't always clear as well, because I think Apple for your home folder actually uses something different. So make sure you set up with the same username and in the same order, and you should be fine when you're then manually copying all your files over. Because if you don't get them in the right order, you can sometimes run into some permissions issues. Again, it's easy to get out of those permission issues, but it's much easier if you just right from the front set up the accounts in the right order. So thanks, Steve, for sending in that little follow-up. Another thing that I discussed was getting old application settings and support files back by copying them out of the Home Library Application Support folder and Home Library Preferences folder. For me, when I do a clean install, I like to install my apps from scratch. For most of them, I just reset up the preferences, but there's occasionally a few apps where I want to be able to bring those preferences over. And my only hesitation there is that's not necessarily totally cleaning and you know, clean installing everything, at least the apps from scratch. And the advantage of clean installing the apps from scratch is if you have some corruption, maybe in your app preferences or something like that, in those support files, you avoid bringing that along from your old system. But if you do want to make that process a little bit easier, getting back up and running with your applications, listener Scott wrote in and told me another way you can do that. He told me about an app called Funny Enough, App Delete. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But App Delete has a feature that you can use to not just uninstall or delete an application, but you can actually archive an application and all of its support files with the app. So what you would do is before you do your clean install, as you're doing your prep and your backups and stuff like that, actually before you do your backups, you would install and run the App Delete app. And then drag into the App Delete window any application that you want to sort of bundle up and keep all of its support files. And what that will do is it'll go out and find all the bits and pieces. Typically, then you would delete the app and it would remove all that stuff from your system. But in this case, what you want to do is click the archive option. And that will take everything, find all those files, zip them up, keep the relative links and locations of those support files intact, and then save them into the home folder, library, application support folder for the App Delete app in a folder called App Delete Archives. Now, that's the default location. You can also save it off someplace else if you need it to be easier to find, but do that. Archive all the apps that you want to migrate, and then back up that entire archive folder someplace safe. Either do it with your backup or someplace where you can get to it after you do your clean install. So you're going to back that up and then do your fresh installation, clean installation of macOS Mojave. Install the App Delete app first and then go into its launch its tools menu and choose the install from library option. Then you can point that back at your archived apps and restore those apps along with their supporting files, and it will do it all back to their proper locations in your fresh new system. So you're not going to have to go digging manually through all these different folders and locations to locate and find all that stuff and get it all back in the right place. It's going to handle all of that for you. And again, I had no idea about this application. And one advantage of doing it this way that Steve pointed out is that in many cases, when you go launch the app after doing this, you're not going to have to re-enter any serial numbers or codes, activation codes or anything like that, because that information will often come along with all of these support files and stuff like that. So that could be handy for some people. Again, my only concern would be it's not quite as a clean install of the applications as doing it from scratch. And if you really want to just migrate all of your applications from your old system and you're not too concerned about app corruption in the support files or preferences files, an easier way than even this might be to just run the migration assistant on your Mac and customize it to only migrate over your applications. And then that could handle all of that for you too. So that might be even a little more efficient than even using this App Delete method. But I thought that was a great tip. And again, thanks to Scott in this case for sending that along. Now, one more little thing that's not, I guess, a little bit of a follow-up to the last episode of the MacCast was we talked a little bit, I think, about Shortcuts, and that's the application that's now in iOS 12 that replaced Workflow. Dan wrote in to tell me about a little disappointment he had as a Workflow user, specifically with the Apple Watch after upgrading to iOS 12, because Workflow actually worked on the Apple Watch, and he discovered when it switched over to Shortcuts with the iOS 12 upgrade that he lost his access to his Apple Watch workflows, which is incredibly frustrating. And I had missed this somehow, I guess probably because I don't use any Shortcuts on my Apple Watch, but no one had pointed this out to me until Dan emailed me. And I started researching and looking into it, and sure enough, he's absolutely correct. There is no version of Shortcuts for the Apple Watch, no way to install it, no way to run those workflows. So if you had workflows running on your Apple Watch under iOS 11 using the Workflow app, those are now gone if you've upgraded to iOS 12. Will they come back at some point? Hopefully. oddly, if you go to the Workflow website, which is still up and running, they still have the page that touts Apple Watch support on the app. So a little bit of irony and maybe salt in the wound there. And hopefully Apple does decide to bring this back at some point. But if you want shortcuts on the Apple Watch, I would say now's a good time to send your frustration and, again, support for bringing it back to the Apple Watch to Apple on their feedback website. So just head to apple.com/feedback and say, hey, we want this back, so please bring it back. And while we're discussing new operating systems, this week I also received a voicemail from Martin. And he had a few Mac OS Mojave questions along with a few other things. So here's what Martin had to say.
Hi, Adam. This is Martin near Richmond, Virginia, with a few follow-up questions to the last show updating Sierra to Mojave and the new file format. I have an iMac late 2012 with a Fusion drive, and since it's now supported, I'd like to upgrade, but have a few questions that draw on your wide knowledge and experience in several areas. What happens to old Time Machine backups in HFS? I heard there are weak links that prevent using them with Mojave. I have a few older desktop programs that are not subscription-based, such as Photoshop, CS5, Office 2011, etc. Can I make a partition after installing Mojave and install Sierra on it to run the old programs? Will they be able to save files accessible to the Mojave partition? Or should I just keep an old external hard drive with a bootable super-duper backup to run the old programs and save files? Again, if I try to save files that way, will I still be able to save them and have them open to Mojave? And lastly, as a longtime 1Password user, I still have the local version instead of the subscription. Should I switch over to support the company? And if I do, can I still store a local copy of the file with all the passwords to make them available without an internet connection? Thanks for all your tips and advice over the years and some of the answers to my recent quandary. Thanks again. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Martin, for your voicemail and your questions. I'll do my best to try and answer all of them. We'll just try and do it in order. As far as I know, with the Time Machine drives still only support HFS Plus formatting, even in Mac OS Mojave. I did a little research on this, and as near as I can tell, that is correct. So Time Machine backups in Mojave should work exactly the same. I did not have any issues transitioning mine as well at all, and I did not reformat my Time Machine drive whatsoever. So there should be no changes needed there. So you should be totally fine there. As far as running older versions of applications in Mac OS Mojave, I know one thing that's almost universally true is that if your application was running in Mac OS High Sierra, it should be running just fine in Mojave. Now, if it was running in Sierra, that may be a different story, but I can specifically speak to one of the apps you mentioned there, Adobe Photoshop CS5. It will run just fine in Mojave. There is a slight little tweak change that you need to make, and actually this is kind of the same for a lot of applications I'm finding in Mojave, although most of them will prompt you for changing this setting. But with a Photoshop CS5, I guess the folks over at Macworld UK, they kind of figured this out, and I'll have a link to their articles that explains what's going on here in the show notes at maccast.com. But they figured out that there was a little setting that you could tweak, and then Photoshop CS5 will run fine. If you don't tweak this setting, it will kind of just lock up, and I think it give you a blank screen when you try and launch the application. But if you go into your system preferences, so after you install Photoshop CS5 under Mojave, if you go into System Preferences, into the Security and Privacy pane, and click on the Accessibility tab, you need to add Photoshop CS5, give it the ability to control your computer. So there's a section that'll say, allow the apps below to control your computer. Make sure that you add Photoshop CS5 to that list. and then Adobe Photoshop CS5 should run just fine. And this is just part of the security protocols that are built into Mac OS Mojave. Apps need to explicitly ask for permission if they need ability to control your computer. And I'm guessing with Photoshop CS5, it probably has to do with some of the automation features that are built into it. I don't really know the specifics, but again, they might go into those in the details in the Macworld UK article, so you can check that out. As far as Microsoft Office goes, I don't know if that will just run or not, which kind of brings me to, I think, the second part of that question, which is, well, should I just leave a, you know, bootable clone backup of my older operating system, Mac OS Sierra, I think it was in this case, and just boot off that? And then can I save my documents and files back to the boot volume for my Mac OS Mojave install, which would be formatted in APFS, Apple's file system? And the answer there is probably not, or really no, because older versions of Mac OS, Mac OS Sierra and earlier, they cannot read or write to APFS formatted volumes by default. There's no way for them to do that. And I'm going to say no with a caveat. And that is, while I was doing my research, I found out that Paragon Software, they're making something they're calling the Retrofit Kit. So Paragon Software Retrofit Kit, and I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. This is a set of drivers that you can install on older versions of Mac OS. Mac OS Sierra, El Capitan, and Yosemite are supported, and it will give them the ability to read and write to APFS formatted volumes. So that is free software. You can go download it. You can install it on your clone. So I guess you could boot into your clone backup, download the Paragon Software Retrofit Kit, and then you would be able to boot off that volume and then potentially read and write to APFS formatted volumes, including the boot volume for your upgraded Mac OS Mojave installation. And again, I haven't personally tried this, but it should work. There should be no reason why that would not work. Now, that being said, I have to tell you, overall, if you're considering upgrading to Mac OS Mojave and you're running that much older versions of different applications, it's probably time to consider upgrading those applications or maybe finding alternatives. So if it's a price thing, if it's a subscription thing, maybe it's time that you find alternatives. You know, Apple's iWork works really great with every Word Office formatted file. There should be almost no problems now opening Word docs, Excel documents, unless they're really, really complex and using very specific Office-only things. But if you're working with documents that are that specialized, I would make the argument that you probably need to be running the latest and greatest versions of Office. And it's not that expensive. The subscription, $10 a month, $120 a year for that level of software, I think it's a fair price and I think it's affordable. Again, if you need it at that level. If you're not operating at that level, you should be able to get by probably with some alternatives and things like that. And that's not to say, you know, I don't understand the dilemma. You know, I understand that software is expensive and not everybody can afford it. And if that's the case, then fine, you know, do the boot off the external. But I feel like at this point, this many versions on, the writing's been on the wall for a lot of us. It's just time to upgrade and move on. If you want to keep upgrading your operating system, if you're okay sticking with the older version of the Mac operating system, and there's nothing wrong with that, that's another viable way to do this. So just my opinion on that. I'm just sharing my thoughts on it. You're welcome to disagree with me. And if you do disagree with me out there, shoot me some feedback, some emails, and make a counter argument. But, you know, it's only going to get worse moving forward. And this comes up in my user group a lot, too. And I say the same thing there. At a certain point, you are going to have to move forward. You are going to have to move on. So, you know, before you get to that point, budget it out. Know that, you know, I use Office. I use Adobe products. This is the new cost of using those products. If I want to move forward, this is what I'm going to have to pay, and prepare yourself for that, because you're going to get there someday. And the more and more Apple puts out new versions of the operating system, the closer you're going to get to that day and point. So again, just my thoughts on that. But then the last question I think you had was regarding 1Password and subscriptions. And we've done the whole subscription conversation over and over again. I don't want to do it to death. I will tell you, you know, pick whatever version of 1Password you think works best for you. If you want to stay on the upfront paid version, I think they're allowing people to do that. I don't think they're pushing out updates to anything other than their new subscription service. But, you know, pick and choose. And again, the older version should run fine and work fine under Mojave. As far as I know, I haven't heard differently. I will make a plug, though, for the subscription version. I held off for a number of versions. I moved over to the family plan subscription version, and I have to tell you, since switching, I absolutely love it. I love all of the new features. I love the syncing with their cloud service, having access to my 1Passwords via a web browser if I need to do that, with the family plan being able to control and set up separate sort of repositories or vaults of passwords for different users. So I have ones where a lot of the passwords that were in my account that were my daughter's passwords, those are now in their own vault that belongs just to them and myself. We share that. So I have access to their passwords. They have access, but each of them don't have access to each other's passwords. That sort of thing. And they can now use 1Password and get that. We have a bunch of family shared passwords that maybe everybody in the family needs to know, like the Apple ID for logging in to get purchases and stuff like that. That is shared with myself and my wife. The kids have their own for that, and we control that. And so the ability to do all that stuff is really, really great. And for what 1Password is asking for their subscription, you know, if you add it up on a yearly basis, I think it is a really great value. I think you're going to get a lot of value out of it switching. But if you don't want to switch, that's fine. If you do switch to the subscription service, I think another question was, what about accessing passwords online? You're not locked into their cloud service. Yes, everything syncs through the cloud service, but it is a sync. So when you're online, all of your locally stored stuff is going to sync across your devices and be synced up everywhere. But if you're disconnected, you still have local access to it. There is a local version of that database. It's not just pulling out of the cloud. So worst case scenario would be if you added something on, say, your iPad, and for whatever reason your Mac was disconnected at the time, it's not going to sync over there. But once both of those come online, you know, say the iPad's online, it will sync up to the cloud. When your Mac comes back online and is able to access the cloud database, that stuff will sync back down. So I've never encountered a problem or a scenario where that's really been an issue for me, where I didn't have access to my full 1Password database. So consider switching to the subscription, but you don't have to do it. You know, if it's not affordable for you, if it's not something that you can really do, there's no problem in sticking with the, you know, pay one time version and just continuing to use that. So make the call there. And I hope that answers all of your questions. I think we did that. So I don't have a particularly fancy car. I drive a paid-for 2001 Subaru Impreza wagon. And, of course, it doesn't have any fancy technology. I don't have an in-dash infotainment system with a screen as much as I would love that sort of thing. And so I have to tell you, I don't get any of the benefits of a fancy CarPlay system. And no, I really can't afford an aftermarket one either. You know, $600-700, maybe you can get them for around $500 now. I don't know. I haven't priced them out in a while. But even $200-300 is not something I'm going to invest in my a clunker old Subaru. But still, a lot of you out there do have new cars, and more cars are coming with things like CarPlay built in. And I have to tell you, I'm extremely jealous of you if you have a CarPlay system. I got to enjoy it on a rental car recently, and it is fabulous. It's amazing Absolutely love it. And it gets better all the time. The maps are improving. You can use third-party apps now with iOS 12. You know, map apps like Google Maps or Waze. So just really cool stuff. Well, this week, Michael wrote in and told me about something. If you are a CarPlay owner, user who has upgraded to iOS 12, probably about something that you might want to know about. And it cropped up for him after he upgraded his devices to iOS 12. Unfortunately for him, though, it was his wife who noticed it first because he upgraded her iOS devices. Just a word of advice, Michael. Don't do that. You know, let them upgrade their devices. Strongly recommend it to them, but don't do it for them because my personal experience, it often doesn't end well, at least not in my household. So, you know, we talk about it and then I let her upgrade. But this was an issue he didn't know she was going to run into. She wasn't really happy about it. And it was that once she upgraded, she was no longer getting notifications from her iPhone on her car's infotainment system. And what seems to have happened is Apple either added or changed a setting. It's not really clear. Maybe it got changed by accident and this isn't the default. But just in case you run into this, I wanted to bring it up on the MacCast. And so it appears that each device, when it's attached or connected to the car's infotainment system via Bluetooth, you now may need to adjust the Bluetooth settings for that device. So a couple things you need to do to make this happen. You need to make sure that you have connected your iPhone or whatever device has been upgraded to iOS 12 to the car's infotainment device in the Bluetooth settings. Once it's connected and set up, go into Settings, Bluetooth on your device, tap the little info icon for that connection, and then you should be able to see a toggle there. There's a toggle for show notifications. And in Michael's case, on his wife's phone, this somehow was turned off. And the suspicion is it was done by default with the iOS 12 update. But if it's not turned on, you're not going to get your notifications on your car's infotainment system. You will also notice maybe a couple other settings in here, things like syncing contacts. So if you want to be able to control that, that's done in this same place. But looks like there may be some new options and toggles and settings in here. And if you have a CarPlay system, if you have a system that integrates, you might want to double check those after upgrading to iOS 12. So thanks, Michael, for sending that information in, passing it along, and sharing it with us. All right, the last thing I have to talk to you about in this episode is some time capsule stuff. I received an email from Peter, who has run into an issue with his time capsule, and he was having trouble finding a resolution. So he's turned to the MacCast in the community to see if we can help us out. And he says he's getting a message on his time capsule now that says, quote, "Time Machine completed a verification of your backups on..." And then it has the name of the time capsule. So in this case, Peter's time capsule. And then it says, "To improve reliability, comma, Time Machine must create a new backup for you. Must create." So it's basically saying it's failed verification. We've got to create a new backup for you. And then it gives you a couple of options. It gives you the option to either backup later or to start a new backup. And if you click backup later, this pop-up dialog will come back again the next day. So basically, you halt or temporarily halt your Time Machine backups to your time capsule. And so Peter was wondering what to do here. He had been putting it off because he's getting ready to do an upgrade to macOS Mojave, and he wants to make sure that he has a backup. And he was trying to resolve this issue before he moved on because he didn't want to lose his current Time Machine backup. And if you choose to create a new one, it's going to start from scratch. I think in the case it keeps the old one and then tries to create a new Time Machine backup in whatever space you have left. But depending upon how much space you have, that may or may not happen. And so I pointed him via email to a Western Digital article that goes into this in great detail. It does a great job of breaking down what causes this problem, what potentially causes this problem, and a couple of different options and resolutions. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But in essence, this message occurs when Time Machine runs into a problem and basically locks the sparse bundle, which is the time machine backup, in essence, and prevents future backups from occurring. And it will do this if there is a damaged sparse bundle. And unfortunately, a damaged sparse bundle cannot be repaired with disk utility. So something's gone wrong with the time machine, basically, Peter. And it can't be repaired. Time machine doesn't know what to do with it. And says you just need to create a new one. So when it's considered damaged, there's really not much they can do about it. And they're simply telling you that fact and saying, hey, you need to start over here. There's an issue. Now, what are the issues that could possibly cause that sparse bundle to become corrupt? Well, things like network issues. So it's trying to do a backup and something goes wrong with the network and it just corrupts itself. Power issues. So in the middle of a backup, you know, the power shuts down or fluctuates or the time capsule resets itself or reboots itself. That can cause a problem. Or just generally hardware failure. Something is physically going wrong with the drive. So if you are running into this issue, you're probably going to want to check and make sure your Wi-Fi is good, that your time capsule is getting a good, consistent Wi-Fi signal, that you don't have any network congestion or problems that might be causing the time machine backup to fail, making sure that your time machine isn't losing power, that it's plugged into a reliable power source. Maybe even you want to have it plugged into a UPS. But ultimately, you probably want to scan the time capsule drive and make sure that you don't have a failing hard drive on your hand. Because the reality at this point is Apple has stopped making time capsules. They've not made them for a while. And time capsule drives are getting older. They're getting to that age where they are going to start failing. You know, 3 years out, 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years out, depending upon when you bought your time capsule. You know, that's pretty much end of life for a lot of hard drives. So it could be that is what's happening here, you know, that simply the drive is just failing. So the last ditch effort, I would say, is just take their advice, start over, reformat. You probably want to go in and actually just reformat your time capsule drive and start up a brand new time machine. Nothing wrong with doing that. See if that works for you, knowing though that that possibly could fail. So you probably, if time machine is your only backup, I would say go out, get an external drive and do a secondary backup, like a cloned backup or something like that, before you go through this process. But, you know, basically reset the time capsule. Start over, start from scratch, see if you can get it fixed up. Run disk utility on it. Again, make sure that it isn't failing, that you're not getting errors. And if you're not, just reformat it and start a new backup. And then let it run and see what happens. If you get this pop-up message again, that's likely a good indicator that you are having a hardware problem with the drive itself. And maybe it's time to just replace that time capsule. And you might be saying, well, Adam, you know, they're not selling the time capsule anymore. I can't get a new time capsule. There are actually now numerous third-party options for doing time machine backups over the network. There are a lot of drive manufacturers, network drives that support it. There are a lot of NAS drive systems, network attached storage systems that support time machine backup over the network. As a matter of fact, I use my Synology to do exactly that, and it works great. I'm backing up a couple of my kids' computers via time machine to a Synology, and no issues whatsoever. You can also get support on the Drobo, Western Digital drives. They make a couple different versions of their network drives that support time machine. So just look for a drive that supports time machine and simply replace the drive, and you can start over from scratch. So should be no problem. But a couple things there for you to try out, and that's likely what's going on with your time capsule. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to talk a little bit more about my Patreon. You know, Patreon is a great way for you to support the MacCast. We are edging toward our first tier goal level. which is $1,500, and I would like to see us get there. So I have reorganized the goals and tier levels for you with a new goal at the $1,500 level. If we can reach that, and we're at about 900, approaching 1,000 now, so that's very achievable, I will do a bonus episode, a interview episode of the MacCast, in addition to the regular shows. So it's going to be a brand new show every other month, and we'll add that into the cycle. So if you would like to help us try to reach and achieve that goal, you can go check out the Patreon at patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to everybody who is already supporting the show. Of course, if you'd like to support the show in other ways, a great way to do that is email in comments or questions, tell your friends about the show, get them to subscribe. Every little bit helps. And also write a review for us on iTunes and be honest about it. You know, you don't have to give it a 5-star rating if you don't think this is a 5-star show. Just give a good, honest rating and let other people know about the MacCast. And I appreciate you doing that. So patreon.com/MacCast. I'd also, of course, like to thank my sponsors on the show, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on their great software at smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.